News. I'm Jim Bertel. U.S. President Donald Trump says he has canceled peace talks with Afghanistan's Taliban leaders after the insurgent group claimed responsibility for an attack in Kabul that killed an American soldier and 11 other people. In an interview with ABC's This Week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the Taliban overreached with Thursday's car bomb attack.
When we saw this action, when we were closing in on a solution and closing in on opportunity for the president to actually meet the decision makers that can actually deliver that reconciliation and peace to the Afghan people, President Trump said, that's enough. We're not going to do that. We're not going to reward that behavior.
He says peace talks are over for now.
I hope it's the case that the Taliban will change their behavior, will recommit to the things that we've been talking to them about for months. In the end, this will be resolved through a series of conversations. I hope the Taliban will agree to meet with the Afghan government.
Negotiators for the U.S. and Taliban have held nearly a year of peace talks. Hurricane Dorian has brought its hurricane force winds to far eastern Canada on Sunday, knocking out power to hundreds of thousands of people. Dorian hit near the city of Halifax, ripping roofs off apartment buildings, toppling a huge construction crane, and uprooting trees. There were no reported deaths in Canada, though the storm was blamed for at least 49 elsewhere along its path. Meanwhile, in the Bahamas, Valentino Burt says conditions are tough right now.
We don't have no power, no water, and it's hard to live over here. It's hard to live. We sleep outside. Even outside isn't even cool.
State media North Korea says Typhoon Lingling has left 5 people dead and 3 injured. Before reaching North Korea, the typhoon hit South Korea, killing 3 people and injuring 13 others. Be sure to download the VOA mobile app and take us on the go. This is VOA News. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is sticking to his Brexit plan and will not seek a delay to Britain's departure from the EU. Reuters' Sarah Charlton reports.
The Prime Minister is sticking to his guns and what he said to get us out of this rut that we're in. We're going to keep going on with the negotiations with the EU. We want a deal by the end of October, but we must leave come what may.
2 of Boris Johnson's top ministers came out fighting his corner on Sunday after a shock resignation from the British government threw yet more doubt and confusion on Brexit. Amber Rudd, Work and Pensions Secretary, quit late Saturday over Johnson's Brexit policy and for expelling 21 rebels from the Conservative Party. Rudd's resignation topped off what Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab described as a rough week. Johnson lost the government's majority in Parliament, failed to force through a new election, and his own brother quit.
Thousands of pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong gathered near the U.S. consulate Sunday, urging President Trump to help liberate the city. Protesters originally took to the streets in June seeking the withdrawal of the extradition bill, which would have permitted criminal suspects to be sent to mainland China for trial in courts controlled by the ruling Communist Party. Last week, Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, announced that her government will formally withdraw the extradition bill. Demonstrators say Lam's moves amount to too little, too late. Republicans in 3 states won't have a presidential primary in which to choose their candidate this election cycle. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
Republican leaders in Nevada, South Carolina, and Kansas have voted to scrap their presidential nominating contests in 2020. While the move is not unheard of for the party of a president seeking a second term, it prompted former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld to ask, what is Donald Trump afraid of? In a statement, he calls voting the ultimate right of speech in America. Weld is one of a handful of Republicans thought to be possible challenges to President Trump for the Republican nomination. Like Weld, former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh has formally declared his intentions. He told CNN that his campaign would fight South Carolina and any other state that considers doing this. Ben Thomas, Washington.
China's trade with the United States is falling sharply as the two sides prepare for more negotiations. There is no sign of progress toward ending a worsening tariff war that threatens global economic growth. Imports of U.S. goods fell 22% in August from a year earlier. Exports to the United States, China's biggest market, sank 16% under pressure from punitive tariffs imposed by President Trump in a fight over Beijing's trade surplus and technology ambitions. The Chinese government has agreed to narrow its trade surplus with the U.S., but is reluctant to give up development strategies it sees as a path to prosperity. I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
There has been a call for the principals to meet so that they can fast-track some of the programs which is running behind the schedule for the pre-transitional period. That meeting with President Salva Kiir will be top on his agenda for tomorrow.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir meets former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar Monday.
The security of Uganda is in the hands of the ruling government. And so they are under the Constitution of the Republic of Uganda under an obligation to protect the lives and the people of Uganda.
Ugandan Internal Affairs Minister blames opponents of the government for the country's growing insecurity challenges.
100,000 people were eager to come to listen to the service of a pope. It is the most public and most popular service he held toward the Malagasy people. Content of the message was human dignity and fight against corruption.
And Pope Francis arrives in Mauritius Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A leading member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLMIO, has confirmed that former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar is scheduled to meet with President Salva Kiir in the capital, Juba, Monday. Manasseh Zindu, the SPLMIO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sport, says the two leaders will discuss efforts to implement the recently signed Revitalized Peace Agreement, among other issues. For more about the scheduled meeting between President Kiir and Dr. Riek Machar, I read Manasseh Zindo in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
It is true. I spoke with Dr. Riek Machar about an hour ago, and he informed me that he will be arriving in Juba tomorrow.
So if he arrives, what is the itinerary? Is he meeting President Salva Kiir to discuss the full implementation of the Revitalized Peace Agreement?
I think that is the main reason why he's going to Juba. There has been a call for the principals to meet so that they can fast-track some of the programs which is running behind the schedule for the pre-transitional period. So I want to believe that meeting with President Salva Kiir will be top on his agenda for tomorrow.
Former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar has expressed initial concerns about his personal safety. What made him sure or confident that his personal safety is guaranteed?
The security concern for Dr. Riek Machar to be in Juba remains still a matter of concern to us. And want the security arrangement to be fast-tracked. But as a sign of commitment, you know, this is not the first time for Dr. Riek Machar to go to Juba. He was in Juba for the peace celebration. So as a sign of commitment, you know, and as a sign of the goodwill with which the SPLM-IO is approaching the revitalizer agreement, he will be going to Juba tomorrow for that meeting. And I think after the meeting, he will travel back to his base in Khartoum.
I also understand the delegation from Sudan's Sovereign Council will also hold talks with SPLM North. Can you give me a little detail about this?
I really don't have much details about the meeting between the SPLM North and the current leadership in Sudan. However, what I have seen in the social media is that President Salva Kiir has been holding talks with the various opposition groups in Sudan, in Juba. Whether this will be part of the agenda tomorrow, I'm not so sure.
What is the significance of the presence of former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar in Juba tomorrow, Monday?
The presence of Dr. Riek Machar in Juba tomorrow is very significant. It's very significant because there are people who still believe that the revitalized peace agreement will not succeed. So, and his continued stay outside South Sudan makes some people, you know, to have a lot of reservation. So he's coming to Juba tomorrow is very significant. I can bet that if it were countries where, you know, the stock market is working very well, tomorrow the South Sudanese currency would have appreciated, you know, against the foreign currency, because his presence in Juba would assure the business, local people, that indeed with the goodwill from both sides, peace could finally return to South Sudan.
So what is the message here to the people of South Sudan? What should be their expectations as the former vice president arrives in the country on Monday?
I don't know whether he will have an opportunity tomorrow to address a rally. If he were to have that opportunity to address a rally, definitely he would have a message for the South Sudanese people. Having been somebody who have worked closely with him, I know that the message, his presence in Juba to the people of South Sudan will be that let them bear with us. Let them bear with us the slow process in the implementation of the revitalizer agreement. The slow process is because we want to have it right this time around. We do not want to return to war again. So his message to the people of South Sudan will be that bear with us as we sort out these technical issues so that South Sudan can experience lasting peace.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports. He spoke with me from Nairobi. General J.J. Odongo, the Ugandan Internal Affairs Minister, says the government is not to blame for the ongoing security challenges. The minister blames opposition political parties, former prisoners and drug abusers for the problem. His remarks follow recent concerns of a surge in kidnappings and rampant killings across the country. But Patrick Oboi Amuriat, leader of the Ugandan Main Opposition Party Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, tells me blaming the opposition is a strong indication that the government has failed its core constitutional mandate to protect life and property of all Ugandans.
This is extremely unfortunate and unguided statement. The security of Uganda is in the hands of the ruling government. And so they are under the constitution of the Republic of Uganda under an obligation to protect the lives and the people of Uganda, which obligation they have miserably failed to execute. And so, for me, I think that the opposition in the country is merely being used as a scapegoat to try and explain to the public the total collapse of the functions and ability of the security forces and their inability, definitely, to take care of our lives and to secure our properties.
Now, but Patrick, the minister is of the view that the NRM has always ensured the protection of life and property, and that is why the NRM keeps getting voted into power and had an overwhelming majority in parliament, because it is attractive and the people of Uganda appreciate the protection given by the NRM and the government.
I think what they should really be addressing now is not the past. If this was happening in the past, which I even highly doubt, maybe if we're living in the past, everybody would hail them for being able to protect us. But we are talking about the current situation that is prevailing. And what the current situation tells us is that our friends in the NRM and internal security have failed in protecting our lives, because there's no single day that passes without a murder being committed, without a kidnapping committed, without somebody being threatened, without a property being destroyed, you know, even if it is by just burglars, you know. So life indeed is becoming so risky here. And so the accolades of the past, much as, you know, they might want to use this as revealing their track record, which again really doesn't augur well with the people, something that is debatable. The current situation is what we are talking about.
But Patrick, the minister is of the view also that the opponents of the government, including your party, the FDC, and other opposition parties, are trying to make the government look bad by creating tension, disaffection, and instability by inciting the public, so the public will lose trust in the confidence they have in the government. Is this what your party and other opposition parties are doing?
First of all, for there to be nothing to be talked about in terms of security of lives and property, I think the country should be secure. We should not be having incidents of murders and kidnaps. And therefore, if it was secure, then what else would the opposition have to say about insecurity in the country? We have nothing to say about that. But secondly, and most importantly, is that we have embarked on a campaign of nonviolence. The FDC as a party, together with Dr. Kizza Besigye, who heads the People's Government, have gone on a campaign to raise awareness within the population to cause an uprising. Never at any one time have we advocated for the killing of citizens, even those whom we hate most. And so those arguments, in my view, are defeatist arguments and cannot really hold in the water.
Now, so what is your response that the NRM will continue to provide protection and that it has demonstrated a clear response to the ongoing kidnappings and all that, and assuring the public that the government will continue to improve security in spite of the criticisms being leveled against it by the opposition?
Well, they should do their work. And really, their actions should speak more than their words. What the people of Uganda desire is that they should be secure, full stop. We want them to come one of these days to the public to say, these kidnaps will no longer take place, the killings won't take place, and that happens. We have had this in the past. And a lot of things, interventions that they have made, promising the people that things would improve, have not improved anything.
Patrick Oboi Amuriat is the leader of the Ugandan Main Opposition Party Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Organization of African First Ladies for Development plans to hold a high-level panel discussion on the importance of ensuring adequate, safe, and sustainable blood for Africa. The discussion, which is scheduled for September 25 on the sidelines of the upcoming United Nations General Assembly in New York, will be in partnership with the Therapeutic Apheresis and Cell Therapy Technologies, Teremo BCT. The BCT is a global leader in blood component. The discussion comes as there is an acute shortage of blood across the continent. For more, I reach Pilana Mugenyi, the Government Affairs and Policy Manager for Teremo BCT in Sub-Saharan Africa.
In Africa, there is really a big crisis in terms of how much blood is being collected. Most African countries do not collect enough blood. and blood is a vital healthcare resource. It's usually used in Africa to treat pregnancy-related complications and severe childhood anemias like sickle cell disease. Now, despite blood and safe transfusion services being essential parts of any strong health system, no African country explicitly references blood safety, sustainability, or availability in its health program. So it's with that in mind, and that being the development challenge, and given the mission of OFLAD and given Terumo's expertise and focus on improving the lives of our customers and doing even more for patients with blood than we do today, we realized that the UN General Assembly presented an excellent opportunity to partner to raise awareness on the importance of blood.
Concerning the lack of ability, or for that matter, awareness and education in this field, how is your organization trying to conscientize Africans, and for that matter, with the help of the first ladies across the continent, to help educate the masses about this?
So what we have in Africa are four mutually reinforcing and complementary strategies that try to address some of the many challenges around availability of adequate, safe, and sustainable blood on the continent. The first is entering into partnerships and supporting initiatives to raise awareness on the importance of blood. And the partnership with the First Lady is one of the major first steps we're taking in this regard. We're going to work with the First Lady to develop interventions to raise awareness on blood, encourage people to donate blood, encourage investment and resource allocation from ministries of health and ministries of finance towards blood, help encourage people to be donating blood on a regular basis, and eventually move to a system in Africa where you have voluntary, non-remunerated blood donors. That's one of the big things we're doing. So the partnerships is one. The second is Terumo is actually developing and rolling out a donor recruitment and retention program which builds the capacity of communities to encourage blood donation. The third thing we're doing is we realize that the research agenda and the evidence for increased investment in blood needs to be developed. So to that end, we have a research agenda for blood in Africa where we're partnering with key research institutes and leading academics and practitioners from across the continent to research the impact of increasing investment on blood and blood systems for African countries and how this will help African countries achieve their SDG and other development goals.
So talking about the upcoming meeting in New York on the sidelines of the UNGA, what specifically are the objectives or aims of actualizing this plan of yours?
We're co-hosting the event with the First Lady, and it's going to be a panel discussion that will bring together thought leaders, policymakers, development partners, academia, private sector, not-for-profit, NGOs, the entire ecosystem of stakeholders who are necessary to drive the blood agenda in Africa. And the objective of this will be to discuss what are the challenges facing blood in Africa, what are the strategies that we can work on together in this multi-stakeholder forum, what are some of the innovations and opportunities that exist, and how can we come together to realize them. Now, the key outcome of that event will be a call to action for all these key stakeholders and partners to work together to increase the research, the investment, the resources, and the awareness on blood safety for Africa. And this event is expected to be the first step towards designing and developing more initiatives, more partnerships, more programs that will ensure adequate, safe, and sustainable blood for the continent.
Filana Mugenyi is the Government Affairs and Public Policy Manager for Terumo BCT in Sub-Saharan Africa. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Pope Francis is scheduled to depart Madagascar to Mauritius Sunday, this after concluding his three-day state official visit to the island country. The pontiff held mass service for the faithful in the capital Antananarivo. Several political and religious leaders attended, according to local media reports. For more of the Pope's visit, I reach Andre Rabamanaja, owner and publisher of Anakao Press Agency.
This morning, very early, around 100,000 people were eager to come to listen to the service of the Pope. It is the most public and most popular service he held toward the Malagasy people. Content of the message was human dignity and fight against corruption. It was clearly a message that was directed to all political leaders that were also attending. There were around 800,000 people that were coming in a very, very, very early from all the regions of Madagascar. Human dignity, fight against corruption, and development, and also importance to preserve what he said, our common house, and respect to give leadership to civil and local society. He says the voice of those who have no voice has to be heard and upheld.
Talk to me about his visit to Pedro, seen as one of the most popular sites in the country.
Okay, Pedro is a humanitarian figure. He's in Madagascar since more than 20 years. And what they do have as common background is that they're all coming from Argentina, and they know each other since a very long time. And they're around the same age. They do have a real link. And I think the engagement of Pedro was a kind of direction inside the content of the message of the Pope. Pedro is an engaged father that has rescued thousands and thousands of poor people. He gave them houses and schooling, and he gave them jobs. Pedro is a prize Nobel, and he has been one of the biggest figures of humanitarian work in Madagascar. What he does, he's supported by universal institutions like countries and governments and NGOs.
So let me ask you, what role does the church play in the life of the Madagascar people?
Okay, the meaning and the role and the influence is very big. And I will take it to you to social first. The social is very present because I think Sunday is a big and major meeting of the people into their social life in terms of moral leadership. But what is far much more interesting is to understand what is the political influence inside the Malagasy world. Vatican is clearly inside the cluster, the associative most important churches of Madagascar. It is an associative cluster called FSKM. In all the crises of the whole history, all the queens during the missionaries, they have had a very major role in terms of referee, mediation, and leadership. Because every time there's a crisis, they are playing the role of support and backup inside support and designations of a succeeded president.
You were at the church service this morning. How were the people of Madagascar, how did they react to the Pope's message?
Well, first of all, you need to understand that people were eager. As I witnessed it and I could see it for myself, people were there starting the night before. You need to understand there are people that are eager to come and meet a spiritual leader. There is a very important Catholic community that is following a spiritual guide. They do have probably, to my opinion, the most important religious community in this country. This community and all the people that did attend this event were really, really eager to meet their spiritual guide. And I think this kind of event is happening like in a lifetime, because last visit of the Pope was 25 years ago, 20 to 25 years ago. And it was a very major and big event for the community and for the Malagasy people.
Andre Rabaman Nanjara is the owner and publisher of Anakao Press Agency. He spoke with me from the Madagascan capital, Antananarivo.
This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, a former Zimbabwean cabinet minister and senior ZANU-PF official Rugari Gumbo has described the late former President Robert Mugabe as a cruel and autocratic leader. Gumbo says Mugabe was power-hungry as he never tolerated any form of opposition during and after the country's liberation struggle of the 1960s. Gumbo, who was expelled from the party in 2015 for allegedly conniving with former Vice President Joyce Mujuru to topple Mugabe, remains bitter to this day. In an interview with Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service, Gumbo, however, gives credit to Mugabe for prioritizing education and giving land to blacks, though he says the process was disorderly.
Well, I'm sorry that Comrade Mugabe passed on this morning. I feel by the fact that his rule was not really fighting, shooting with the new democratic system which we are witnessing in the country, or which we are witnessing in the world. I think he was cruel. He was autocratic as far as I'm concerned. He didn't treat us freedom fighters, particularly commanders in the army. And personally, I was tortured by him. And as you all know, I've spoken about this before. He even fired me from the party. He humiliated me. He didn't operate like someone who was a comrade and close to him, because I had stayed in jail with him for quite a number of years before. And for me personally, I don't have kind words for the old man. He's my nephew by the fact that his mother comes from the Gumbo family. But all the same, I couldn't take his sort of cruelty or his authoritarian tendencies. He left a trail of destruction as far as I'm concerned. He destroyed the careers of so many young men, so many people, and I cannot tolerate it. We want a democratic, all-inclusive kind of leadership, and that one we didn't get because he didn't provide a proper succession plan. As a result, we ran into the problem that we are in today. So the suffering of Zimbabweans today is partly or mainly because of his bad management.
But Mr. Gumbo, in all that dark side of former President Mugabe, there should be a speck of light. What can you pinpoint as something that is positive former President Mugabe brought to Zimbabwe?
Well, the only two things really I can say is that he made a major contribution. That is the area of education. I think he did a fantastic job, opened new schools, gave us free primary education, free primary and secondary education, resulting in us currently having a over 90% literacy rate in Africa. I think that's one is the highest, perhaps. That is an area which has been very important. There is also the issue of land that he managed to give land to the people. The acquisition of land might have been to some extent disorderly and so on. But all the same, he gave us land, and it is up to the people, I think, to produce. But other than that, I don't see anything really which I can say.
There were reports that Mr. Mugabe had vowed never to be buried at the Heroes Acre. Say this is true. What's your take on that?
Oh, well, it is right to decide where he wants to be buried. And I think we should be open and transparent enough to allow a person to decide where he wants to be buried. Is he a hero or not a hero? He should decide where he wants to be buried. The fact that you are a hero doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be at the national sign. You can be buried at your home. Fine, as far as I'm concerned, we should enforce or impose the burial of a person or a hero. People should choose where they want to be buried.
Rugari Gambo is a former cabinet member in former President Robert Mugabe's cabinet and also a former member of the ruling ZANU-PF party. He spoke with Jonga Kandemiri of VOA Zimbabwe service from the capital Harare. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Somalia won their first ever World Cup qualifier with a narrow 1-0 victory over Zimbabwe on Thursday. Ranked number 202 in the world, Somalia halted the run of 19 successive defeats, stretching back 8 years to secure their first qualifying win. And while Sid Al Shakunda headed home the only goal of the game in the 87th minute in a match played in Djibouti, due to security problems in Somalia. Zimbabwe, who played in the Africa Cup of Nations finals 2 months ago and are 90 places higher in the world rankings, will host Somalia for the second leg on Tuesday. Elsewhere on Thursday, Ramadan Agab notched a hat-trick as Sudan beat Chad 3-1 away. And 2 goals in 4 minutes helped Rwanda to a comfortable 3-0 away win over the Seychelles in their first-round first-leg qualifier in Victoria. Rwanda hosts the return leg in Kigali on Tuesday. Djibouti had a surprise home 2-1 win over Eswatini. The teams meet again Tuesday in Manzini, and the aggregate winners will join 39 other countries in a 10-group second round starting next March. Liberia were the only other team to win at home in 8 first-leg ties played on Wednesday. Under new English coach Paul Butler, Liberia earned a 3-1 win over neighbours Sierra Leone in Monrovia. Mozambique were one of 3 teams to win away from home as they edged Mauritius 1-0. The return leg is scheduled on Tuesday in Mozambique. A late penalty from centre-back Kananu gave Guinea-Bissau a 1-0 win at Sao Tome and Principe. All 3 goals in Namibia's 2-1 win in Eritrea came in the second half. Wednesday's other 3 first-leg ties all finished in draws. There were 2 late goals in a 1-1 draw between Burundi and Tanzania, who both played at the recent Africa Cup of Nations finals in Egypt. It was also a 1-1 draw as Equatorial Guinea took on South Sudan in a match played in the Sudanese capital Khartoum, as South Sudan Stadium is being rebuilt. Lesotho earned a goalless draw in Ethiopia. Still in football, former 4-time African Player of the Year Samuel Eto'o has announced his retirement from his glittering 22-year career as a professional footballer. The 38-year-old former Cameroon and Barcelona star posted a short message on Instagram stating, I quote, "The end towards a new challenge." Eto, Cameroon's all-time leading goal scorer with 56 goals in 118 games, also enjoyed brief stints in the English Premier League with Chelsea and Everton. Eto helped Barcelona win 3 La Liga titles as well as 2 European Champions League crowns. In 2006, Eto became the first and only African to win the Spanish La Liga Golden Boot, scoring 26 goals in 34 games. At Barcelona, the Cameroonian forward scored 108 goals in 144 games before sealing a move to Inter Milan in 2009, where he won his third Champions League crown, as well as an Italian Serie A title and the FIFA Club World Cup in 2010. In athletics, two-time Olympic 800-meter gold medalist Casa Semenya has joined the South African women's football team. The 28-year-old is unable to compete without taking testosterone-reducing drugs, following a rule change by the IAAF athletics governing body. It means she cannot defend her 800-meter World Championship title in Doha this month, though she's fighting the rule change through the courts. She is now training with Gauteng-based women's football club, JVW. Semenya is not the first athlete to switch football. After retiring in 2017, Usain Bolt trained with the Norwegian club and Australian side Central Coast Mariners, but did not secure a contract. Semenya is also following in the footsteps of her former coach, Maria Mutola, who also turned football after athletics. And in tennis, Bianca Andreescu stunned Serena Williams with a 6-2, 7-5 victory to capture the 2019 US Open title. With the victory, Andreescu becomes the first Canadian singles player to win a Grand Slam event, and the 19-year-old jumps into the top 10 in the WTA rankings after winning her first major title. Williams, meanwhile, has lost each of her last four Grand Slam finals, all with a chance to tie Margaret Court's record of 24 Grand Slam singles titles since returning to tennis after giving birth to her daughter. In the men's finals, Rafael Nadal will move within one of Roger Federer's haul of 20 Grand Slam titles if he beats first-time major finalist Daniil Medvedev in Sunday's US Open showpiece. Second seed Nadal, who is 33, is the favorite to win his fourth title in New York. Russian fifth seed Medvedev, who is 23, has lost just two of his past 22 matches, including a defeat by Nadal in August's Roger Cup final. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link you up with again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. You are hearing from Fele Bongale Lutaya with Nakazana. And then David Lutalo comes up next with Nakukulachi. Sabano, Yango to Gende, Olimoka Mosaja. Omokaso Mokumba Wachitiwa, Nevavena Omoku, Sirim Baba Wambu Havatisa. Moka Mosaja, Chintu Chamuendo, Nevavera Omoku, Gabu, Gambia Tisanabe. Kwa damu
makai negeri jengwa galang kutia jangwe tonda ba wombadara ewe samanzi jetu tese masima tomba kompitula katino jangu tulele mkwano vivera mweviruma bambi tutese ikwe manyati vyo siri kate vikola ameketa meketa mumuti modavanga mberenge yiji chonkutula na kukola chichichi wachuka mkwano kwa mira gocha
Mukabu, baby, so bizobia fabusa, putima, nasense buka, no manze nan sotoka. Oh, save my life.
Nakukola chichichi wachuka.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. An African colossus has fallen. Robert Gabriel Mugabe, a credible freedom fighter and a Pan-Africanist, passed away last Friday in Singapore at the age of 95. He was a man who was born at a time in Africa when living south of the Zambezi was not a pleasant one for non-white Africans. But he grew up determined to fight white minority rule wherever he could find it. He joined other African leaders in Southern Africa to do that. In fact, he was not the one identified by Western governments and intelligence service to emerge victorious in Zimbabwe. But by dint of perseverance and dogged determination, he became the first president of Zimbabwe in 1980. At a time when the name Mugabe has been so tarnished by the Western media and Western governments, it is hard to believe that in the first 20 years of his rule, he was a very pragmatic leader, to the point where he was losing some support from the more radical element in his country. He invested enormously in education and health, and very few complained about Mugabe's rule at that time. It was only after 20 years that Mugabe turned his attention to the most troubling issue in Southern Africa, the issue of land. Mugabe knew that to tackle this issue would be like crossing the Rubicon, but he felt that now that apartheid had been defeated in Southern Africa, that Namibia had become independent, that Angola was free of Zavimbi, that Mozambique was now has received peace, that he should tackle land. And then all hell broke loose. People forget that the deterioration in Zimbabwe began after that land issue was taken by Mugabe. Mugabe is a man you can find not an ounce of fairness or inferiority complex. Rather, he's a man who was always mindful of his capabilities. And when you combine that with his obvious gift of the gab, he tended to look at all the Western criticism as mere gibberish. He was unforgiving to those of his domestic opponent whom he believed were siding with the West, and that caused him a lot of problems. Perhaps Mugabe should have left the stage earlier and passed the torch to a younger generation. Perhaps Mugabe should have found ways to reach out for reconciliation with the people of Matabele, where a bloody civil war was conducted. But the problem was that when he lost his first Ghanaian wife, you could see that there was a difference in Mugabe. Mugabe fought for the independence of Zimbabwe. He fought for the liberation of Southern Africa. And it is sad that there is so much complex reasoning about how wicked this man was. But when the military 2 years ago removed him, they were careful not to fall into a trap by damning him. They still respected him. They still held him in awe. Mugabe was a happy warrior against colonialism, against imperialism, and against white minority rule. It is not an accident that, contrary to all most African leaders, Mugabe sought medical attention in Asia, in Singapore, a country whose leaders he firmly respected. He always believed African leaders should stand up for the rights and dignity of the African continent. This is a legacy that Africans should always bear in mind. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Mpuga, and engineer for today, Xiaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, one who causes others misfortune also teaches them wisdom. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA.